nooses and I'll say good riddance.
Diana and Charlie watched the men come out of the fire station, the horses pulling the wagon, the men in their uniforms with metal hats gleaming in the light of the street lamps. Then they headed back towards Soho. It would have taken them hours had they not caught a ride in a wagon heaped with cabbages that was most likely, Diana thought, heading to Covent Garden Market. In this, she was right. Diana, as usual. She did not bother to ask the wagoner's permission, of course. She grabbed the back of the cart, hoisted herself up, and climbed in among the cabbages, crouching down so the wagoner would not notice. Charlie followed her up and into the wagon, catching his foot on the edge and falling against the side, but the wagoner did not hear or turn around. Even if he had, what could he have seen in the dim light? Their clothes quickly became permeated with the smell of cabbage, but they were so tired and dirty that it scarcely bothered them. They slipped out of the wagon just before it reached Covent Garden. The stalls were not yet open, but vendors were already piling up their produce, turnips and onions that had wintered over, lettuces and peas sown early, strawberries grown in greenhouses, peppers and aubergines brought in ships from warmer climates. As they walked through the market, following the narrow alleys between the stalls, a pale yellow sun rose over the buildings of London. Suddenly the flower girls began their chant. Flowers for sale! Lovely flowers! Fresh from the country! When they'd left the narrow alleys behind and were once more on familiar ground in the streets of Soho, Charlie said, You know, Diana, you're the best liar I ever heard.
Ain't I, though?
Diana reached into her pocket and pulled out an apple.
I'm a pretty good thief, too. If I'd told him we were there on a Sunday school outing, he would never have believed us. People are always ready to believe the worst.
She took a bite of the apple and then handed it to Charlie.
Here, share and share alike. Not too big a bite, mind, or I'll keep it all for myself.
The sun was up in the sky by the time they reached Park Terrace. Diana rang the bell. Mrs. Poole answered the door with an,
Oh, it's you, is it? Don't you both look a sight? What did you do? Sweep chimneys. Come in then, both of you, and get yourselves some breakfast. And tell me where Miss Mary is, because I haven't seen hide nor hair of her since yesterday. It's mortal worried I've been, and I hope they're all right, those girls.
Chapter 18. Back to Park Terrace. How is he? Asked Mary, rising from one of the wooden benches provided for visitors. This seemed to be a night of sitting on hard benches, but at least they had made it here, all of them, and Captain Mudge had only charged them £5 after all.
Because it's you, Mr. Holmes, he had said. Wait until I tell the little woman who I ferried up the Thames tonight. Sherlock Holmes himself, and a bunch of circus performers. She won't right believe me.
The doctor says he'll recover, but it will be a while before he can use that arm again, said Holmes. I'm grateful to Miss Rappaccini for speaking with the physician. My medical knowledge is, I fear, too specialized for such a case. And, of course, to Miss Frankenstein for carrying him to the infirmary.
He bowed to Justine, who had followed him and Beatrice up the stairs to the infirmary with Watson in her arms. They had been gone for almost an hour, while the rest of them waited below, Mary sitting on the bench, with Alice falling asleep against her shoulder, Hyde handcuffed to one of the rails, Catherine pacing back and forth, Renfield crouched in a corner, muttering about his flies. Once, Hyde had turned to her as though about to speak, but she had looked down and checked the time on her wristwatch, then wound it as though completely intent on the process. She had no wish to speak with him, not now.
It was nothing at all, Mr. Holmes, said Justine.
Perhaps carrying a man up a flight of stairs was nothing to a woman who could strangle beast men with her bare hands.
Yes, It will take time, but with exercise he should regain the full use of it, said Beatrice. She took off the surgical mask and gloves she had been wearing while in the infirmary. She had not wanted her breath to foul the air. Mr. Holmes, when you said this was a hospital, I imagined it would be a medical facility. I did not expect a charitable home for veterans.
Yes, the Royal Hospital has housed the injured veterans of our wars for more than a century, said Holmes. Here they may live out the rest of their days in peace. I knew if such a wound could be treated anywhere in London, it would be here. And, of course, Watson himself is a veteran of the Afghan campaign. Mr. Holmes! Mr. Holmes! A man with a halo of silver hair ran down the hall toward them. I can't let you go without telling you what a pleasure it is to see you here, and Dr. Watson as well. Although, of course, we're not pleased he's been injured. Far from it, I assure you. I'm the secretary of the hospital, and if there's anything we can do...
He bowed to Holmes, then looked at the women in their various states of undress with surprise.
You can take care of Watson, said Holmes, for which service I will be most grateful. Your physician assures me that he will recover fully in time. Other than that assurance, all I require at the moment is a cab or carriage, so I can take a dangerous criminal to Scotland Yard, or rather two carriages for hire, so these young ladies can make their way home as well.
Is there anything more we can do, Mr. Holmes? Asked Mary. She had wanted to go upstairs too, with Holmes, Beatrice and Justine, but they could not leave Hyde or Renfield, so she and Catherine had stayed in the hall and waited. It had been frustrating, sitting and waiting, out of the action. She could have done more than serve as Alice's pillow.
"Can you take Miss Frankenstein and Miss Rappaccini back to your residence?" asked Holmes. "They've had a long night. I need to take Hyde and Renfield to Scotland Yard. Miss Moreau, if you could accompany me, I believe they would remain on their best behaviour."
Why was Catherine going to Scotland Yard, while Mary was going back to Park Terrace? It wasn't fair. She could have guarded Hyde and Renfield just as well. She didn't have Catherine's teeth, but she still had her revolver. She nudged Alice, and the scullery maid opened her eyes sleepily. "Is it time to make breakfast yet, Mrs. Poole?" she asked, yawning. Then she looked around and said, "Oh," as though suddenly remembering the events of the night. Mary stood up and rubbed her aching shoulder. Holmes took her elbow. She was so startled at the gesture that she almost jumped back. He leaned toward her and said in a low voice,
"I don't wish to alarm the others, Miss Jekyll. They believe our enemies have been defeated, but we don't know whether Prendick escaped or where he has gone. We believe the beast men he created are dead, but we can't be sure. Certainly one got away in the confusion. We don't even know whether they had other confederates. I have asked Hyde, but he refuses to speak. It's still dangerous out there. I trust you to keep them safe from harm, Miss Rappaccini, Miss Frankenstein, and that girl whom I take to be a servant of yours."
He looked at Alice curiously.
"As soon as I can, I will return with Miss Moreau, and we can reconvene, as it were. I think Miss Frankenstein knows more than she has told us. We need to hear her story."
"All right, Mr. Holmes," said Mary. "I think I have just enough money left for the fare." She was disappointed at being sent home, but he was right. She had to get Beatrice and Justine safely back to Park Terrace. He had taken her elbow. He had spoken to her in confidence. She did not quite know what to think, except that it was new, and she liked it. When the secretary himself told him the carriages were waiting on Royal Hospital Road, they went out together. Just before Hyde mounted the steps into the first one, he turned to her and said,
"Mary."
It was the first time he had spoken to her directly. Mary looked at him. The crooked man with a face that might have been charming, had it not borne such signs of past dissipation and malice. He seemed cautious, almost pleading. She looked away. She did not wish to speak with him.
Not here. Not now. Perhaps later, after he had been charged with the murder of Sir Danvers Carew. Perhaps then she would visit him in prison, before his trial and hanging. Then she would ask him, what? Why he had performed those experiments? Where he had been all this time? How he could have treated her mother and her and even Diana so badly?
At least, continued the rasping voice, at least I was able to see Ernestine once more, before she died.
See Ernestine? When had he seen her mother? Mary turned back, but he was already in the carriage across from Renfield, with Catherine climbing up the steps behind him. I'll see you at home, said Catherine, then pulled shut the carriage door. Holmes was already in the carriage as well, having entered on the other side. And then before she could say, wait, the driver cried, gee up, and the carriage rattled away across the cobblestones. She stared after it. The face at the window, the face her mother had raved about before she died. Had it been the face of Hyde?
Mary, are you all right? Said Beatrice. You look as though you've seen a phantasma, a ghost.
They were all waiting for her, Beatrice, Justine, and Alice, looking at her curiously. She did not know what to say. If her mother had seen Hyde suddenly at the window after all those years, what would it have done to her? Killed her, most likely. The window was on the second floor, so how had he... But no, she had seen Diana climb. No doubt Hyde could climb as well. She remembered her mother in those last few weeks. Delirious, raving. Then the precipitous decline. Her hair spread out on the pillow. Mary could not think about it any more. Not now. She had to get the others back to Park Terrace.
Come on, said Mary. Let's go home.
Catherine, there was no need to envy me. I can't think of anything less interesting than taking that snivelling rat to Scotland Yard. Diana,
that's Dad you're talking about. And yes, I know how you feel about him, Mary Contrary. It doesn't change the fact that he's our father.
Catherine, I meant Renfield. Going on and on about eternal life, and how he had been promised, and giving Hyde covert glances all the while. And Hyde ignoring him, ignoring all of us. Holmes tried asking him questions about the Alchemical Society. Who was involved? Where was it headquartered? What was its agenda? But he just stared out the window. And when Holmes tried questioning Renfield, he started in on his flies and spiders. Finally, we arrived at Scotland Yard. He got out, and suddenly bobbies appeared from I don't know where. One of them ran to tell Inspector Lestrade. Holmes talked to Lestrade for a few minutes, while Renfield and Hyde were taken away in handcuffs. Then he got in the carriage again and we headed back to Park Terrace. He said he wanted to talk to Justine as soon as possible. That was it. Pretty disappointing, and not at all an adventure. Also, you got breakfast before we did.
What took you so long? Asked Diana.
She was sprawled on the parlour sofa, in yet another of Mary's nightgowns. How many of them were left? Her hair was wet and combed back, no doubt the work of Mrs. Poole. When she sat up, it left a damp spot on the sofa where she had been lying.
You look remarkably clean, said Mary. The ogress forced me to take a bath before breakfast. She would have forced Charlie too if he hadn't bolted out of here double quick. And I don't blame him, though he didn't get anything to eat.
Oh, I put something in his pocket, said Mrs. Poole. I should have held you under the water until you stopped talking. Running around London dressed like a newsboy at all hours. What sort of behaviour is that for a young lady? Good Lord! Is that little Alice?
Yes, ma'am, said Alice.
It's a long story, said Mary. Right now I think we all need food, except maybe Beatrice. For the first time she realised that she was famished.
Just tea for me, please,
Beatrice started to say, when thunk, like a tree falling in a forest, Justine fell over onto the carpet, exactly where the pigman had lain 2 nights ago.
"Justine," said Beatrice.
She knelt by Justine and examined her without touching.
"I think she's fainted again. She's been so strong all night, but I wondered when the strain would begin to affect her. Mrs. Poole, can you bring the sal volatile, and if you have any brandy?"
Even after Justine had revived, Diana administering the smelling salts with perhaps too liberal a hand, and Mary giving her sips of brandy out of a small glass, it took both of them to help her up the stairs to what had once been Dr. Jekyll's bedroom, which Mary supposed was now Justine's bedroom. Beatrice followed them up.
"Justine, I was so ashamed of myself for having fainted again. After all, I am the giantess, the strong woman."
Beatrice,
"It's not strength. I have explained to you. It's a matter of blood pressure, of how Frankenstein created you. All of us have our weaknesses."
They deposited Justine in bed.
"I'll stay with you, cara mia," said Beatrice. "Perhaps Mrs. Poole can bring you up something to eat, and you should sleep."
"I cannot yet," said Justine. "Mr. Holmes said he wanted to talk to me as soon as possible. He wanted me to tell him everything I know about Adam. But you should all have breakfast. You do not need to stay with me, Beatrice."
"Don't be silly. Of course I will stay." "She doesn't eat, anyway," said Diana. "But I'm still hungry."
"You've already had breakfast," said Mary. She turned to Beatrice and Justine.
"I'll ask Mrs. Poole to bring up something for you both. Should she stay? This was her house, after all." "No, it was their house, too. Let Beatrice stay. She did not have to be responsible for everything." Mary felt a sense of relief. There were others to share the responsibility now.
When she and Diana entered the morning room, Alice was already eating a breakfast of eggs and buttered toast, wolfing them down as though she was starving. Alice:
"Which I was."
"Lord, wouldn't Mrs. Poole rag me if I ate like that?" said Diana.
"Alice is a good girl and you are nothing of the sort," said Mrs. Poole, coming into the morning room with a tray on which there was a pot of tea and another stack of toast. "I want Miss Mary to sit herself down and eat before she collapses from hunger. Here's more tea, and there's milk and sugar on the table, and butter in the dish, and I almost forgot the orange marmalade. I bought a new jar yesterday, as someone seems to have a bottomless stomach. Shall I fry up an egg for you, miss?"
"What about for me?" asked Diana. "I wouldn't mind another egg."
She sat on one of the chairs, drawing her legs up under the nightgown so her bare feet were on the chair cushion.
"As though you haven't already had two," said Mrs. Poole. "If you want more, you can have toast. And try not to sit like a monkey."
Diana stuck a fork into the piece of toast on top of the pile, moved it to her plate, buttered it lavishly, then spread a thick layer of marmalade over it.
"Just toast for me, please," said Mary.
She was hungry, but the thought of an egg turned her stomach. She poured herself a cup of tea and wrapped her fingers around it, grateful for the warmth. How long had it been since she last sat at this table? 2 days? Could it only have been 2 days? It was as though time had passed differently. And here she was, back again at the same table in the same room, with morning sun streaming through the lace curtains. It seemed completely different.
"Well," said Diana after Mrs. Poole had left the room, "did you talk to him?"
"To whom?"
Mary added 2 lumps from the Minton sugar bowl, with its pattern of birds and flowers, that her mother had purchased as a bride newly arrived in China, and sipped her tea. Yes, that was exactly what she needed.
"To Dad, of course," said Diana. "Did you talk to him at all?" Ask him anything?
No, said Mary. I'll talk to him when he's properly in prison.
And there she would ask him... What?
Whether he had climbed up the wall, looked in through the window? Whether he had killed her mother?
Intentionally or not, it scarcely mattered. Ernestine Jekyll lay in her grave, in the churchyard of St. Marylebone.
Oh, you are so stupid, said Diana. Why didn't you talk to him when you could? I wish I'd been there. I would have asked him all sorts of questions, like where he's been for 14 years. I bet he wasn't with Adam the whole time. I bet he travelled around and had adventures, and you didn't even ask him about them.
Mary felt an urge to throw her teacup at Diana.
First of all, he may be your father, but he's certainly not mine. My father died the day yours took control of his body and life. Second, I have no wish to know about his adventures, whatever they might be. I want to know where the money went, and how he could have abandoned...
Her mother.
Her.
She did not want to tell Diana about her suspicions. Not yet. After all, it wasn't Diana's mother who had been killed. Mary had been the one to watch her mother die, to stand by the grave as her mother's coffin was lowered into the ground. She gripped the teacup tightly, and then she reminded herself that Diana's mother had died a pauper's death, with no one to care for her, or even bury her properly. She put the teacup down on the table, afraid she might break it.
Third, you do not call me stupid in my own house.
I calls it as I sees it, said Diana. And he is as much your father as he is mine, sister. Do you think your precious Dr. Jekyll simply disappeared when he turned into Hyde? He's still there. He's always there. He may look different, but Hyde is just another name he calls himself.
She gripped the butter knife, as though at any moment she might fly across the table and attack Mary with it. Alice stared at them both, turning from one to the other, fascinated yet fearful, wondering if there was going to be a fight right here in the morning room. Just then the front doorbell rang.
That will be Catherine and Mr. Holmes, said Mary. I didn't expect them to return so quickly. They must not have spent much time at Scotland Yard.
Had they left Hyde there in police custody? They must have.
A moment later, Holmes strode into the morning room ahead of Mrs. Poole, who was looking flustered.
Mrs. Poole. And a good thing, too.
I don't know what the two of you would have done without him to calm things down.
Diana.
Good thing for Mary. I would have thrown the knife at her.
Catherine, you mean good thing for you. Why do you think none of us notices any more when you get angry? You get angry all the time and then it passes like a spring storm. But when Mary gets angry...
Diana,
when Mary gets angry, she sits there and stares at you. She doesn't even say anything.
Catherine, it's what she does after that. Remember Count Leopold? We had no idea she was going to shoot him.
Mary,
he deserved it. Also, I don't get angry. I just dislike it when people are rude to my friends.
The author feels obligated to point out that this remark was greeted with a collective snort.
Where is Miss Frankenstein? Said Holmes, looking around the room.
Upstairs, said Mary. She fainted again. She's not as strong as she seems. You must not upset her.
Forgive me, said Holmes. My manners are atrocious.
You could say that again, said Catherine, sliding into the morning room behind him around Mrs. Poole.
I won't allow you to endanger Justine's health, Mr. Holmes. Not even inadvertently. She's strong, but she's also very sensitive, particularly to emotional strain. Every once in a while her heart gives out. Remember that she died and was brought back to life. You can't treat her like an ordinary woman.
Mrs. Poole, are there any kippers?
That's exactly what I want to ask her about, said Holmes. With your permission, Miss Moreau, and yours, Miss Jekyll, I can see how much you all care about each other. May I speak with her? If I am less abrupt than I unfortunately can be when pursuing an inquiry.
He looked so chagrined that Mary felt sorry for him. He had not meant to be rude. He was just, well, he was Sherlock Holmes, and he always would be. She must not expect him to behave in any other way.
"She's in bed," said Mary. "But she's prepared to talk to you. I think it would be all right if you went up to her. I'd rather not make her come down. Catherine, what do you think?"
"Honestly, I'd rather you let her rest, but I doubt she will until she's spoken with you. And I think she needs to talk about what happened, or she won't be able to let go of it. That's how Justine is. But are there any kippers, or maybe sausages?"
Holmes nodded.
"Then if the good Mrs. Poole will countenance such unorthodox behaviour, I will go up to her room and speak with her there."
"I'll go up with you," said Mary. "I'm almost done."
"I'm not going to miss this," said Diana, shoving toast into her mouth.
"Well, we can't all go up," said Mary crossly. "This isn't some sort of circus."
"With Mr. Holmes as Atlas, the strong man," said Catherine, pouring herself a cup of tea, as though amused at the thought.
"I'm certainly going up, if only to make sure he doesn't give Justine a fit with his line of inquiry. Where is the milk jug?"
Alice handed it to her.
"Are you coming up too?"
asked Mary, smiling at Alice. After all that had happened last night, she did not want Alice to feel left out.
"I'm just a scullery maid, miss," she replied, shaking her head rapidly like a sparrow. "No more adventures for me, thank you. I'll clear up here and then bring something up for Mr. Holmes and Miss Moreau. They need their breakfasts too, I'm thinking."
And then, despite Mary's concern that they would all be too much for Justine, they trooped upstairs, Mary leading the way, with Holmes and Catherine and Diana trailing behind. Justine was sitting up in bed, looking pale and tired, but composed. Beatrice was sitting in a chair by the bedside, drinking more of that green sludge she seemed to favour. Justine had toast and what looked like a bowl of vegetable broth on a tray, but she had not touched it. When they entered, Beatrice moved back toward the window and opened it a crack at the bottom to let in air.
"Mr. Holmes," said Justine, "you see, I have been waiting. You told me that you wanted me to tell you everything I know about Adam Frankenstein. It's little enough, I'm afraid. Before last night, I had not seen him in almost 100 years. Even with what I know of him, I would not have thought him capable of such atrocities, cutting up women. He was always violent, but impulsive, not calculating. I would never have imagined."
Holmes sat on the edge of the bed and took her long, pale hand.
"Forgive me, Miss Frankenstein. I do not mean to distress you. But you understand, I'm sure, why we must know everything. Adam, Hyde, and Prendick were all involved with this secretive society, although in different ways, I suspect. Prendick seems to still be a member, Hyde was cast out, Adam was never admitted. And Renfield, what is his connection? Why did Hyde choose him to pin the murders on? You see how complicated this case has become. I doubt Renfield will give us any useful information. He is too sunk in his madness. Hyde may speak, once he has spent some time in Newgate. I have arranged for an interview with him, after he is charged and imprisoned. Meanwhile, any additional information may lead us to the Société des Alchimistes."
Justine nodded.
"I will tell you everything I know."
"And Mr. Holmes, I found this on the bookshelf while searching for something to read to Justine."
Beatrice picked up a book from the side table and handed it to him. Over his shoulder, Mary saw the title in gilt letters on a green cover. "Frankenstein, a biography of the modern Prometheus."
"I believe of us all, only Dr. Watson and I have read it. My father believed it to be an accurate account of the creation and death of Adam.
We know now that it is at least partly false. Justine was not destroyed, and Adam did not pursue his creator into the Arctic waste and die there. I do not know why Mrs. Shelley falsified information. Nevertheless, I believe we should all read her book.
I've read it, said Catherine. It was on Moreau's Island. That's how I knew to look for Justine.
Well, I shall read it as soon as possible, said Holmes, examining the frontispiece. A pursuit through the Arctic. It sounds quite the shilling shocker. Miss Frankenstein will tell us to what extent it can be trusted.
Catherine, although it's not at all a shilling shocker, she was a very good writer, you know.
Diana, why are you interrupting your own story?
I've never read it myself, said Justine. But I will tell you my story and you can judge. Perhaps if you will all sit down.
Holmes nodded and withdrew to the other chair. Mary and Catherine sat at the foot of the bed. Diana shamelessly plopped in bed next to Justine, sitting cross-legged and with her chin in her hands, as though listening to a bedtime story. Just as Justine was about to start, Alice brought up a tray with a plate of toast and eggs for Holmes and a plate of kippers for Catherine. She gathered Mary's and Catherine's empty teacups on the tray, then headed once again toward the door. Justine sat up against the pillows, took a sip of water from a glass on the side table, and said,
"If you will pardon a preamble, I shall begin at the beginning, or my beginning, as it were."
Alice stopped and stood, half in and half out the door, leaning on the doorframe, as though even she could not help listening after all. Chapter 19. Justine's Story.
I do not remember my life before I woke on my father's operating table, except in glimpses. My mother, a widow to whom I was simply another mouth to feed, sitting in her rocking chair by the fire with my brothers and sisters around her. She wore a faded black dress with a white lace fichu around her neck and looked older than her years. The Frankenstein's grand house on the shore of Lake Geneva, with its walls of grey stone, beneath mountains whose peaks were always covered with snow. In spring we would gather wildflowers on their slopes and make crowns for ourselves, the upstairs maids and kitchen maids, even the fat old cook. Only the housekeeper was too proud to wear one. The courtroom in which I was condemned to death, and the faces of the good men of Geneva, solemn beneath their white wigs, looking at me as though I were an insect, the lowest creature on God's earth. I do not remember my first childhood, or how I grew up in the Frankenstein household. But my father told me my history, how I was sent in service to his family when I was no older than Alice, how I was treated well as part of the Frankenstein family, how his mother loved me, and how I was considered almost a sister by his cousin Elizabeth, who had lived with the Frankensteins since she was a child. I was trained as a nursemaid for the Frankenstein boys, first for his younger brother Ernest, and then for the youngest, William. Victor, the eldest, was already in school, and soon to depart for university. He told me that I was a happy girl, always laughing, with golden hair and eyes like the sky above Lausanne in summer. That is what he told me, but I do not remember. One day, William was found dead, strangled in the woods. The house was searched, and a locket that he had been wearing with a portrait of his mother in it was found among my clothes. I was accused of his murder. I, who had taken care of him since birth, who would never have harmed a hair on his head. It was Adam who had killed him, in a fit of rage, when William, meeting him in the woods, called him an ugly ogre. He confessed it all later to my father, confessed to the murder, and to putting the locket in a pocket of my apron. He was responsible, both for William's death and for mine. but the jury did not know of Adam's existence, so I was condemned to death and then hanged.
Catherine, Frankenstein should have told them.
Justine, we've had this argument before. How could he have convinced them that he, a university student, had created a man out of corpses and brought it to life? They would never have believed him.
Catherine, he should have found a way. His family was one of the most important, one of the richest in the region. The Frankensteins should have protected you.
Justine, but they believed me guilty. Only my father knew the truth. And remember, I confessed.
I should not have, but the priest told me I could only have absolution if I confessed to the crime. I thought that without absolution, I would not be able to enter heaven or stand before God, who knew I was as innocent as the bluebells that grew on the mountain slopes. I know now that God is merciful and would have understood, but I was only 17 and frightened.
Catherine, I wonder which of them would win in a contest for worst father. Frankenstein, Rappaccini, Jekyll, or Moreau?
The night after my hanging, Adam came to my father and threatened him. If he did not make a monster out of me, a monster like him, Adam would kill the members of the Frankenstein family one by one.
Mary, why you, Justine? Why did he ask for you specifically?
Diana,
well, she was a convenient dead body. I mean, she'd just been hanged.
Mary, you really are the worst. You know that?
Diana,
what? It's true.
My father told me that Adam has seen me on the day of William's murder. I was worn out from searching for the boy and had fallen asleep in a barn on a pile of hay. That was when he put the locket into my apron. He must have thought me attractive, I suppose. So my father agreed that he would do this thing, bring me back to life, for Adam to be his mate, but not in Geneva. He had heard of new surgical techniques developed in England and would travel there to study at the Royal College of Surgeons. Then he would travel to a remote location where he would not be disturbed in his work. He preserved the parts of my body and packed them into a trunk. Very cleverly, he told me. But of course I remember none of this. What I remember is the waking, as though coming up through water. Up and up until I thought there would be no surface and I might drown. Then I took my first breath, gasping and staring wildly about me. There was a light like the moon, but it was the lantern over the operating table. The first words my father said to me were, "Justine, are you awake?" There was pain, a great deal of pain. Catherine and I talked about this when we were in the circus of marvels and delights. We are both made creatures. That is why I think we understood each other immediately when she found me. She said, "Do you remember the pain?" And I said, "How can I forget it?" But I healed.
"Can you walk?" my father asked.
I stumbled like a child to a bedroom he had prepared for me. For weeks I lay on a mattress filled with straw, half awake, half in fevered dreams. Then one day I opened my eyes, and the sunlight was golden, the sea continually crashing against the rocks below. I could hear birds and insects. The fever was gone. I was alive. "I was so worried," he said to me later. "I thought I would lose you again." So you see, he cared for me. He loved me. I thought of him as my father because I remembered no other before him. Justine Moritz's father had died when she was a child. It was Frankenstein who gave me life again, the life I have now. I had to learn how to walk, how to eat with a fork and spoon, how to read first words and then sentences. All these he taught me, carefully, patiently. He had brought a woman's dress for me, but it did not fit. In creating me, he had necessarily made me larger, elongated the joints. He was not a trained surgeon, just a university student. He did not have Moreau's skill. At first I had to wear his clothes, although the trousers were too short for me. But I found that if I cut the bodice off the dress and sewed a new waistband, I could make a serviceable skirt. I used the same needle and thread he had used to stitch me together. Over it I wore a shirt of my father's. When it was tied with a sash, I looked respectable enough. Slowly, slowly I learned. For months we lived peacefully in that lonely cottage, with its stone walls and low thatched roof. Once a week he would take a boat to what he called mainland, for we were on an island, one of the Orkneys, I found out later. Despite its name, mainland was one of the other islands, the largest of them. We were on one of the smaller islands. Once a week he would come back with food, flour, sugar, whatever we could not grow in our stone-walled garden, or procure from the few poor cottagers who lived on that island with us. No one bothered us, and I was not seen except by sheep, and once a shepherd boy from a distance. Our days were simple. A breakfast of porridge, then a walk across the hills or down to the rocky beach, and perhaps a game of ball to increase my coordination. Then study. He taught me so much. I suppose out of sheer boredom as much as a desire to educate me. As Justine Moritz, I had been merely a servant, who could read fairy tales and add numbers as long as she was using the fingers of both hands. As Justine Frankenstein, I read Aristotle and discussed the sorrows of young Werther. My father had brought two trunks, one filled with me, the other filled with books. I soon exhausted them and started reading my favorites a second time. I knew it could not last. He told me as much. Elizabeth, to whom he was betrothed, was waiting for him, and he would need to get back to his university studies in Ingolstadt. But I was young, in mind if not in body, and I did not think much about those things. My world was the wind-swept stone cottage at the top of the cliffs, and our meager vegetable garden, and the restless, eternal sea. Justine. That's good. Restless and eternal. Thank you, Catherine. You make me sound so much more eloquent than I am. Catherine. You wrote that, actually. You're a better writer than you think. Justine. Oh, surely not. After all, English is not my native language. If I could have written it in French. Catherine. You're just as annoying on this subject as Beatrice. Your English is perfectly fine, if a bit Miltonic for a modern audience. And then, one day, he appeared. The monster, Adam. We were sitting in the sunshine at the top of the cliff on which our cottage was situated. I was sketching. My father had taught me how, to help with my fine motor coordination. He had brought pencils and a notebook to make anatomical sketches, but I used them to draw butterflies, or the flowers that grew in the nooks and crannies. Sketching became my favorite occupation, a way to record the wonders of the natural world around me. And I found that I had an exact eye, a skilled hand. Again, I do not know if that is Justine Moritz or the Frankenstein in me. My father was sitting on the grass, reading from Plutarch's Lives. Then suddenly I heard a roar, as though of a wild animal.
"So here you are, my tormentor, traitor. How dare you sit in the sunshine while I live in darkness and despair?"
It was Adam. Although I think now that my father should have named him Lucifer, in his pride and fury he reminded me of the fiend himself. My father rose and stumbled back. I screamed, thinking he might fall. We were sitting close to the edge of the cliff, with a view of another island across the firth and the waves crashing below. But he found his footing. I remember him standing there against the blue sky, towering over me, although really he was a foot shorter than I am. "You cannot have her," were the first words out of his mouth.
"Cannot," said Adam. She is mine. You created her for me at my command. And now you dare tell me what I cannot have? Remember, Frankenstein, the lives of your family are in my hands. I have killed William. Shall I also kill Ernest and your beloved Elizabeth?
No, no, said my father, putting his hands to his head. Let me think. Give me time to think.
You've had all the time you deserve, said Adam. You, he said to me, come with me. You were created for me, to be my companion and mate. We shall go off to some desolate corner of the earth, where we shall live out our miserable existence together.
I am not a you, I said. I am Justine, and I am a rational creature, capable of determining my own actions. I have no desire to go to some desolate place, nor yet to be miserable. I can guess who you are. My father told me that before me he created a creature deformed and malicious. You are that creature, are you not? And now you say I was created at your command. That may be true, but no promise my father made to you before my birth can bind me. I am capable of reasoned thought and therefore free, so says Monsieur Rousseau. By your threats you have already proven yourself unworthy of such as I am. I do not choose to accompany you. Adam stared at me in astonishment.
You have been educating her, reading and discussing with her, as you never did with me. Now I see the full extent of your cruelty, Frankenstein. You created her to mock me, to taunt me with the love I should have had, which you intend to keep from me forever. You rejected me as your son, and she has rejected me as her mate. At your command, no doubt.
He lunged at my father. I stepped between them, attempting to thwart his attack, but he was stronger than I was. He thrust me aside as though I were made of straw. And then I saw his hands around my father's throat. I screamed again and beat his back and arms with my fists, but to no purpose. I saw my father's face go red and then his body go slack, and there was nothing I could do to save him. I think there is no man on earth stronger than I am, but Adam was not a man, not as ordinary men. He had the strength of Lucifer himself. In a moment my father lay dead, strangled by the foul creature he had created. Adam lifted him up, then threw him as though he had been a stone into the churning waters below. And that was the last I saw of my father, Victor Frankenstein. Adam turned to me.
Take me to your house, he said.
I led him to our cottage, farther down the cliff, where a hillock gave some protection from the wind. And so began a period of my life that I do not wish to dwell upon. For months, we lived as man and wife. I did what he bade me, the housework, preparing our food. Soon we ran out, and although we had money, neither of us could take the boat to mainland. He told me with what fear and cruelty he had been treated, how even children had pelted him with rocks. He was certain we would meet with a similar reception. Instead, he foraged among the hills, bringing back herbs and roots, sometimes an entire sheep stolen from a herd. He spent his days looking at an atlas that was among my father's books, determining where we should go. To the wilds of South America? To parts of Africa where the natives had never yet seen a white man? The Arctic? He wanted a place where we could live undisturbed and raise our children. For he wished us to have children. He did not know it was impossible, that in the process of assembling me, my father had removed the organ popularly believed to cause hysteria. From an excess of caution, I suppose. I am like any other woman, but I cannot bear a child. I feared Adam too much to tell him the truth, and seemed to accept his plans. What else could I do? He was stronger than I, and ever watchful. He tried, I think, as well as he could, to make me love him. In the evenings we sat by the fire and he would talk to me of philosophy, history, literature. Indeed, if he had not been my father's murderer and my captor, I might have been charmed. He was as intelligent as my father, perhaps more so, and I could speak with him on many topics. I learned much during those conversations. But always, as the fire burned down, he would say,
"It is late, Justine. Come to bed."
And I would remember that I was not a free woman. I knew that if I left while he was foraging for our food, he would follow me. He had the senses of an animal, and I was the only one of his kind, his mate. If necessary, he would follow me to the ends of the earth.
"We are man and wife,"
he would say to me. "Not in the sight of God," I would say. "Not until we are united by a minister." And then he would rage against religion, like a free thinker and radical. Lying beside him at night in the bed where my father had once lain, I thought of throwing myself off the cliff. After all, I was already dead. Surely God would not punish me. But then I thought, what if I am still Justine Moritz with an immortal soul? A soul that belongs to God and not myself, which will one day reunite with its true creator. No, I could not kill myself, not while I believed myself to still be God's creature. And then I thought that perhaps I should kill Adam. He had already killed William and my father. They would never appear before a jury as Justine Moritz had. Perhaps I had a duty to be his judge and executioner. But even if I could find a way to overcome his greater strength, I lacked the courage. I could not kill the spider that wove its web in a corner of the ceiling. I had never killed anything in my life, and could not do so now, in my death life. One night, he was sitting in my father's chair, waiting for me to finish making our dinner. My father had brought several bottles of whiskey from mainland. He used to drink a glass after dinner, to aid digestion, he said. I thought it was foul stuff myself, but then I have never liked the taste of spirits, not even as Justine Moritz. Adam had found the bottles and taken to drinking, first after dinner and then during the daytime. That night he had already drunk several glassfuls of the amber liquid, and he was excited. He had finally decided that we would go to Africa. With our superior strength, we could traverse jungles and deserts that made the interior of the continent dangerous for white men. We would see what no European had ever seen. Surely the rude savages would worship us as gods. All day he had been talking about it, asking if I wished to go to Africa with him, there to start a new race, more than human. I would be his Eve in that distant paradise. Eventually our children would return to Europe and rule over civilized men who had grown weak and overconfident through their use of technology. I said yes. Of course I was excited at such a prospect. I agreed with him so he would not get angry, to keep him in good humor. I was cooking potatoes in lard over the fire, stirring them in a skillet with a wooden spoon. The skillet was set on a metal grill directly over the flames. I was trying not to burn the potatoes, and although I said that yes, we would go to Africa to start a new race there, I suppose my distracted assents did not satisfy him. Suddenly, he was next to me.
"You are going to love me, are you not?"
he asked. He smelled of whiskey.
"Justine, look at me. Tell me that you will love me in time."
I looked up at him, startled. This was a question he had never asked before. I did not love him. I loathed the sight of him, and at that moment he saw the truth in my face. He roared with rage and caught me by the throat.
"I shall make you love me. You shall either love me or die."
I gasped for air. What madness was this? We were the only two of our kind in the whole world, and he would kill me? I, whom he had called his Eve, whom he considered a mate and the mother of his future children? But he was enraged, and the whiskey was clouding his mind. Slowly I could feel his hands closing around my windpipe. I still had the handle of the skillet in my hand. I swung it toward him, flinging the hot lard and potatoes into his face. He screamed and let go of my throat, stumbling back and clawing at his eyes. I did not give him time to recover. If I had, he surely would have killed me. I swung the skillet, hitting him on the side of the head. Over and over I swung it, hitting him about the head as he staggered back, then fell on one knee, roaring and still trying to see in pain. Blow after blow, for he was so strong that it took many to fell him. Finally he lay on the ground, still. I did not know if I had killed him or merely rendered him unconscious, but as soon as he was no longer moving, I dropped the skillet and ran out of the cottage and down to the shore where my father's boat was pulled up beyond the tide mark. I lifted it and carried it to the water, then pushed it out as far as I could. I got into the boat and began to row. I had never done such a thing before, and it took a moment to adjust to the oars and the buoyancy of the water beneath me. But I had seen my father do it, and I stroked as he had. Slowly but steadily I rowed away from that island, south toward the Scottish shore. I worried about missing it, not knowing how the ocean currents might carry me. But I consigned myself to God and prayed that he would guide my boat. If he wished me dead upon the seas, that was his prerogative. At least I would not die by Adam's hand. Night fell. But my father had taught me about the stars, so I continued to row, heading always south. When the sun rose, I saw that I had reached a rocky shore, and I breathed a prayer of thanks that I had not crashed upon it. I did not know where I was, but I pulled my boat up on the rocks and climbed to the highest point, a hill of scrubby grass. There I looked about me. As far as I could see, there was nothing. The sea on one side, and barren hills on the other. What could I do but walk, following the shore, knowing that sooner or later I might reach a fishing village? To the west, the shore veered south, so I went both westward and southward at once, with the wind howling over the hills on my left, and the sea crashing on my right. After 3 days of walking, I came upon a village, a small one tucked into a cove. It was clear that the village made its trade from the sea, for there were fishing boats in the harbour. I know now that it was a tiny place, scarcely a hamlet, but at the time it was the largest I had ever seen. I was starving. I had been walking for 3 days, all day and most of the night, sleeping as little as possible, curling into what crevices I could find. I could go a long time without food. Nevertheless, I felt the pangs of hunger like any other creature. I'd eaten some berries that grew on the low shrubs. No berries were poisonous to my constitution. I had eaten mussels washed up on the shore, and some snails, raw, because if Adam was following me, a fire might alert him to my presence. I knew how the people of that village would treat me. For Adam had told me how men and women treated our kind. Even the children had thrown rocks at him, called him monster, driven him from their midst in fear. But the town had a bakery, and I could smell bread, fresh because it was still morning. It stirred a distant memory of Justine Moritz taking a basket of bread, fresh from the oven in the great kitchen of the house in Geneva, to her mother's house. I imagined what that bread would taste like and thought, what if they kill me? Perhaps I deserve death after all, not for my actions which I thought had been justified, but because of what I am. That is what hunger and tiredness will do to the mind. At last even the instinct of self-preservation begins to go. I walked into that village, my clothes stiff with mud and salt water, my hair tangled like a bird's nest.
The fishermen saw me first, back from their morning's catch, gutting their fish or mending their nets. They stared